From South Carolina to Oregon, Pennsylvania to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, recent polling shows a majority of Americans think our economy is in a recession. But is it? We get the answer from E.J. Antoni at the Heritage Foundation. Former President Donald Trump has expanded the electoral map by putting states like Minnesota and Virginia in play. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. China may be an economic power, but its economy is showing signs of weakness. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Samuel Gregg of the American Institute for Economic Research. And Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary on the vanishing heroes from World War II. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. By the numbers, the U.S. economy is doing rather well. But at the kitchen table, families are struggling. E.J. Antoni is a public finance economist at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to discuss reasons for the disconnect. E.J., welcome back to American Radio Journal. E.J., there was a poll out about a week or so ago now where the pollsters found that a majority, over 50% of Americans, feel that our economy is in a recession. Now, we don't have numbers that specifically technically point to that, but why is it, you suppose, that people think that the economy is in a recession?
I think it's because their own personal finances, their family finances, are what's in a recession. And that tends to happen when the broader economy goes into recession. But what we're witnessing today is this huge expansion of government spending, particularly government deficit spending. And that is essentially pushing off the technical recession for a really long time. The problem is, it's not helping out the average American. It's not helping out the typical American family who's suffering right now.
Driving this, of course, is inflation. And you had a recent piece, Biden Lied, Your Wallet Died, talking about the fact the president claimed that there was over 9% inflation when he took office. What is the historical accurate record as to where we stood with inflation when the Biden administration began?
Well, according to the Biden administration's own data, these aren't even my numbers. This is the number from the Biden administration. It was 1.4%, not 9%. It didn't reach 9% until this president and his big spending allies in Congress had put their agenda into place. And a year and a half into his administration, that inflation finally ran all the way up to 9%. And so at the end of the day, look, this problem comes from one place and one place only. That's Washington, D.C. The government is spending, borrowing, and printing much too much money to the order of trillions of dollars. And that's destroying the value of the dollar. It's robbing you of your purchasing power, and it's driving up prices everywhere. And the reason we continue to see inflation, the reason we continue to have these price increases everywhere from the grocery store to the gas station to the hardware store, you name it, it's because the government continues spending much too much money.
Taking a look at all this money the government is printing, what is it about the printing of money, EJ, that creates an inflationary cycle such as the one we're currently in?
Well, if you imagine you have a glass of whiskey and you start adding water to it and you're diluting the whiskey, the overall volume is still rising in the glass. So it's not as if the amount of whiskey is increasing, but you are increasing the total amount of liquid. That's essentially what happens when the government is printing all of this money to pay for its deficit spending. You're diluting the value of the dollar. That's the whiskey. So the total volume is going up, but you're not actually increasing the amount of what matters, the value of the currency, the whiskey in the glass.
Well, a lot of people may be driven to that whiskey glass with the way the economy has been going here. Taking a look at this going forward, you talk about all the spending that has occurred. We had something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which spent trillions of dollars. Obviously, from what you're saying, that spending of trillions of dollars had the opposite effect.
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the most deceptively named pieces of legislation, I would say, in my lifetime. Because what that did was it threw fuel on the inflation fire. And if you look at a lot of aspects of the economy, which the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, was supposed to help, only months after the IRA was signed into law, those different sectors of the economy really started to stagnate. Manufacturing is a great example of that. The IRA was supposed to add millions of so-called green energy jobs in construction and manufacturing, and yet those sectors turned anemic and basically lost all of their growth only a few months after that was signed into law because of the very damaging effects from that piece of legislation. So it hasn't slowed inflation. Instead, the IRA has slowed growth.
Not only do we have the inflationary cycle weighing on the American family, but talk for a minute, if you will, here, EJ, about interest rates and the fact that the Fed has not cut interest rates this year as it was expected to do.
Part of the problem with the Fed right now is they're trying to square the circle. They're trying to help create all of this money for the government to spend while simultaneously not trying to cause inflation. But the problem is you can't do that. As you create excess money, you by definition are creating inflationary pressures in the economy. And so the Fed is trying to promise the American people, hey, we're going to cut rates, but we're also going to bring down inflation. And those goals are essentially at loggerheads today because of the excess level of government spending. Now, if you could get the government spending down and you weren't having so much borrowing out of the Treasury, then you could actually start bringing down inflation and interest rates at the same time. But the problem is that's not the situation in which the Fed finds itself today.
So, of course, if we have government spending driving inflation, looking ahead to the budget that will be, well, it's supposed to be adopted by the 1st of October, never actually happens. But is the Biden administration calling on reining in spending to try to bring this inflation under control, or have we not learned a lesson?
Oh, my goodness. Have we not learned the lesson? No, I would say that's the understatement of the day. Dear goodness, not only do they have zero intention of holding the budget where it is, let alone reducing the budget, they are planning for the biggest budget ever. I mean, bigger than any war we've had, bigger than COVID, bigger than any recession, you name it. They want record-setting budgets year after year from here on out. I mean, not only have they not learned their lesson, they are doubling down on their failure.
We have been talking with EJ Antoni, who is a public finance economist with the Heritage Foundation. EJ, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where can folks find you on the web?
Well, the Heritage Foundation is an organization dedicated to really building an America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and a civil society flourish. We are all about educating our fellows, whether that's grassroots or politicians and anyone and everyone in between. The best place to learn more about Heritage is going to be heritage.org. And the best place to find me is going to be on X. And the handle there is @RealEJAntoni.
EJ Antoni of the Heritage Foundation. EJ, thank you for being back with us.
No, thank you for having me again.
At the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson is keeping an eye on not only the presidential race, which we are going to touch on today, but also some of the swing state Senate races that are up. And we also have some key congressional races. Going to cover the waterfront with Scott Parkinson. Scott, always a pleasure having you here.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Let's start out with the presidential race. A recent poll in Virginia has Trump and Biden tied. We're seeing former President Trump campaigning in states like New Jersey and Minnesota. Scott, is the electoral map expanding here beyond the traditional battleground states?
Absolutely. And I think it's because independent voters are fed up with the radical left, inflation, indoctrination, and this illegal alien invasion on our southern border. The bottom line is, a year ago in Virginia, Roanoke College polled this race, the same methodology that they released this week, and a year ago it was a 16% race. Then they polled it in August. Something started to happen. It was a 9% race. Then they polled it in November, 4% race. February, 4% race. And now this May, it is 42-42. They're dead even. And I think that that spells trouble for Democrats all across America. We obviously have a really slim majority in the House of Representatives. You've got a United States Senate that is incredibly close as well. And when you have a presidential candidate that's so strong at the top of the ticket, like Donald Trump, it will provide coattails to other races and make them even more competitive. And there is an interesting stat released from the Washington Post, of all publications, earlier this week. And it talked about only five of the current U.S. senators winning their election while their party's presidential nomination, while their party's presidential nominee lost their state. And so in 1996, Mitch McConnell won Kentucky, even though Bill Clinton won the presidential. And in 1992, Chuck Grassley won Iowa, even though Bill Clinton won Iowa. In 2012, Mitt Romney won in West Virginia, but Joe Manchin won the Senate race. And in 2012, you also had John Tester win Montana, while Mitt Romney won in that state. Susan Collins has been sort of an anomaly. She's won three different times in Maine, while a Democrat has won her state. But what I think is interesting about this is you've got competitive races here in Virginia against Tim Kaine, Pennsylvania against Bob Casey, Michigan, an open race. You've got competitive races against Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin. You got Arizona, which is, again, an open race. You've got Nevada. You've got all these states that Trump is performing really, really well in right now. And is the historical trend that we've seen over several generations going to hold true? Or are we going to see Democrats somehow create a message that helps them perform above Joe Biden, who certainly is a drag on their ticket? I think that we're going to have a big election for the United States Senate map.
Republicans have a bit of an advantage here when you look at the Senate races this year. Do they not, Scott? There are a lot more Democrats having to defend their seats.
Yeah, that's true. You know, there's a couple of races that I didn't even mention because I kind of consider them in the bag. But in Montana, we've got a good shot to defeat John Tester with Tim Sheehy. And then in Ohio, Bernie Moreno is going to defeat Sherrod Brown. We've already effectively picked up the West Virginia race because Joe Manchin retired. And so there's just a really favorable map for these Republican candidates. Now, obviously, the Democrats are good at two things, lying and raising money. And they've raised more money than the Republicans in these races. And that does give them some level of a strategic advantage. But there's a good news here because we've got a lot of time left before November. And ultimately, when early voting begins in some of these states in late September, isn't it hard to believe that there will be early voting that early? But it's true. And so I think you're going to see more of a direct voter contact campaign beginning in the middle of the summer and really going after those swing voters, locking them in and making sure that they understand Republicans have a vision on policy to save our country.
In terms of the House of Representatives, there's been a lot of movement relative to different states having court cases that have determined what district lines are going to look like for House seats. Overall, the big picture there, Scott, those court cases, the decisions that have been made, are they advantaging Republicans or Democrats? And does this open the door for Republicans to get a majority more than the couple of votes that they've had the last couple of years?
That's a great question. You know, I think candidly, it's almost a wash. And we lost a congressional district in Alabama, but we gained a couple in North Carolina. We lost a couple in New York. So when you look at the map overall and you try to figure out what are the swing state congressional districts that are in play, where can we pick up seats? You know, you're going to be looking again at vulnerable Democrats in states like Texas, like Florida. I think there could be pickup opportunities in states like Michigan. And obviously, California has a couple that have always been really, really tight. And when you think about the independents that are leaving Joe Biden, are leaving the Democrat Party, I think that it really gives us an opportunity to build maybe a 15-seat majority in the House of Representatives.
Well, we certainly have a lot at stake here. And I keep wanting to say the November election, but as you pointed out, it really gets underway in September. So we are going to keep an eye on all of those things, and we will see how the verdict in the Trump trial and the debate here, the presidential debate that's scheduled for the end of June, how all that affect things. And we'll have all that analysis with Scott Parkinson. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is the premier free market economic conservative organization defending liberty, opportunity, and free markets. If you want to check out the candidates the Club for Growth PAC is supporting, visit clubforgrowth.org. Follow us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loman.
China is a growing military power, but its economy is not keeping pace. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more about the Asian nation's economic woes from Samuel Gregg of the American Institute for Economic Research.
Sometimes it seems like a lot of American foreign policy these days, everything from Joe Biden's newly announced tariffs to the CHIPS Act to President Trump's tariffs and a lot of what Republicans are aiming to do in Congress and if they get back to the White House, a lot of that seems to be aimed at countering China or responding to a threat from China. But as my guest today will argue, China's economic facade seems to be cracking all on its own. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Samuel Gregg. He's the Friedrich Hayek Chair in Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. That's AIER. You can find his work at AIER.org. And he's the author of an essay, a recent essay, making exactly this point, that China's economic facade is cracking. Sam, been a big fan of your work for a long time. Glad to have you here on the show for the first time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric. It's good to be with you.
It's fantastic to have you here. Why does China's, China's obviously tremendous economic growth in the last few decades. I think it's understandable why a lot of American policymakers are to varying degrees concerned or worried about what that means for the United States and the world. But you've got a different perspective. Tell us.
Yes. Yeah, so as you say, China is the subject that seems to be driving a lot of the drift to economic nationalism that we see across the left and the right in the United States today. And my fear is that many of the policies that are being proposed across the political spectrum to address the rise of China, they seem to be focused upon this idea that China is somehow going to overtake the United States economically and as a global power. And I think if you look very carefully at what's going on in the Chinese economy, this is simply a false set of principles to be operating by. So we could start with things like the demographic problem, serious demographic problem that China now has, a self-inflicted one, I might add. But because of the one-child policy pursued between 1980 and 2016, China now has the European upside-down demographic pyramid problem, right, whereby you have an increasingly elderly population and a shrinking pool of younger people. Now, that creates problems for spending choices, whether it's on pensions, welfare, all the things that happen when you have an elderly population. And in the case of China, this means that it's going to consume a lot more capital than would otherwise be spent on things like infrastructure, R&D, and of course, defense. So now we see the Chinese Communist Party is telling people, now you need to have 3 children each. Now, the problem, of course, is that demographic changes are very difficult to reverse once they get into place. So I think that's one big problem. It's also the case that China is employing a lot of interventionism across the economy. And you mentioned in your remarks that China has obviously grown immensely over the past few decades. But that growth has primarily come because China engaged in a selective liberalization of parts of its society and parts of its country, really from 1979 onwards, up until around about 2008, 2009. China's reversed that. Now they're using a lot of industrial policy. The government is playing a major role in directing investment. Its Belt and Road Initiative has consumed trillions of dollars. And we know that this is having some severe effects upon the growth prospects of the Chinese economy, whether it comes to things like the fact that all these state-owned businesses are so much more inefficient than privately owned ones. This, I think, this extensive use of industrial policy, the shift back to the state, the resumption of more state direct control of big businesses and small businesses comes with all the problems that readers of Reason magazine already know come along with those types of policies. And there's no reason to assume that China won't experience the same difficulties as any other economy. Again, I worry that American policymakers are framing policy, be it trade policy or foreign policy or defense policy, vis-a-vis China. They're doing it in a way that's addressing a mirage, a myth that we have about China in our heads. And that is always a mistake.
Yeah, we are responding to the imagined threat rather than the reality on the ground. We're talking with Samuel Gregg. He is the chair of economics and economic history at the American Institute for Economic Research, talking about his recent essay on how China's economic facade seems to be cracking. Sam, not a lot of time left here, but I do want to pivot back domestically. And I find some sort of there's something poetic about the fact that the one-child policy in particular, which you already talked about, is so critical and so central to China's, some of these economic problems that are baked into China, because that was a centrally planned authoritarian policy, right? And now the consequences of it, obviously, different than how they were intended originally. Is there a lesson there? And I assume there is for American policymakers.
Yes, because America has its own demographic problem. We are not replicating ourselves fast enough. Our birth rate is below the 2.1 children per woman. That is the replacement rate for any society. Now, we've managed to avoid a lot of that in terms of the negative consequences as a consequence of immigration. Immigration is what has enabled America up to this point to avoid some of these problems. But as you and all your readers and listeners know, we're trapped in a type of immigration box right now, whereby neither side of politics is interested, as far as I can tell, at reforming immigration policy in a way that allows it to contribute to the growth of the American economy, and that also takes care of those legitimate national security concerns that a lot of Americans have. Neither side of politics is serious about trying to deal with this problem. And so to that extent, yes, immigration is helping us to deal with our own demographic challenges, but our immigration policy is such a mess that I don't think that it's currently structured in the most optimal way that would help us to even to overcome our demographic challenges in an even more efficient and effective way.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. But I think the other thing, when you're looking at which economy is the stronger one, I think you look at how many people are leaving China and how many people are trying to get into the United States. You know, if the flow was reversed, I would be more worried about China than I am. And again, we're out of time, but I think there's something there worth thinking about. Sam Gregg from the American Institute for Economic Research. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
And again, that's Samuel Gregg. He is the Friedrich Hayek Chair for Economics and Economic History at the American Institute for Economic Research. Find their work online at AIER.org, including his recent essay on how China's economic facade seems to be cracking. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The recent observance of Memorial Day reminds us that we are losing the last of our World War II veterans. American Spectator Editor-in-Chief Dr. Paul Kengor reflects on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Last Monday, Americans remembered Memorial Day. It's a somber day for me personally, and of course for all of us. This time, Memorial Day made me think of two things in particular, both related, namely my recently deceased friend Charlie Wiley and Pearl Harbor. I think often of my late friend Charlie. My colleague, Dr. David Ayers, and I plotted to bring Charlie to Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where we both teach every spring semester for years. Our young students were enthralled by this extraordinarily colorful old guy holding forth with stories from his incredible life, beginning as a childhood actor in the 1930s through his internationally known antics fighting the Cold War, for which he made headlines, including once being thrown in jail by Castro in Cuba in the early 1960s. Charlie's life was so fascinating that when he died at age 95 in March 2022, I wrote a tribute to him for the American Spectator titled "The Most Interesting Man in the World," named after the Dos Equis commercials. The title suited the man. Look up the article. Check it out. But among Charlie's best stories related to Pearl Harbor. On December 7th, 1941, that day of infamy, Charlie was attending a football game at New York's Polo Grounds. At halftime, the announcer curiously read off a list of high-ranking military and political officials who were in attendance and ordered them to, quote, call your office immediately, unquote. No reason was given to the baffled fans. Said Charlie, quote, it was not until seconds after the last play of the game that we were told that Pearl Harbor was being bombed by Japanese planes. Our country was at war, unquote. Before dawn the next morning, Charlie headed off to the Marine Recruiting Office in Lower Manhattan, and there was already a two-block-long line. Notably, Charlie was only 15 years old, but he was ready to fight for his country. When he finally got to the recruiting sergeant, the sergeant asked for Charlie's birth date, for which Charlie had a well-rehearsed fabrication. The incredulous sergeant sensed, however, that Charlie wasn't quite the age that he thought. He asked him for a birth certificate. Well, no luck. Charlie would have to wait until he turned 18, which wasn't until 1945. He ultimately found himself at Okinawa. When Charlie told this story, his point was less about himself than his countrymen at the time. He wasn't alone in this desire to defend Uncle Sam, as that long line in Manhattan, of all places, attested. Said Charlie, quote, as news of the Japanese attack spread, the most vehement of the anti-war activists immediately lined up behind our country, unquote. I thought of Charlie's Pearl Harbor story when I recently learned that the last survivor of Pearl Harbor's USS Arizona had passed away. This man's name was Lew Conter, and he died at age 102 on April 1st, 2024. Lew was one of only 335 Arizona crewmen who survived the day of infamy. He remembered, quote, guys were coming out of the fire, and we were just grabbing them and laying them down. They were real bad. You would pick them up by the bodies, and the skin would come off in your hands, unquote. The 20-year-old Conter, Wisconsin native, stayed alive through the long remainder of the war. We finally lost him on April 1st, 2024. It's sad that these men are gone, as is the country that they served. Yes, the country, I think, is gone too. Charlie Wiley used to lament to me, it's all gone, Paul. Everything, the sights, the smells, the feel, it's just such a completely different world and different country. You just can't even imagine. Charlie and I talked about how attitudes are different too, including the sense of service and allegiance. We wondered whether American boys today would line up blocks long in Manhattan or anywhere to fight overseas voluntarily if the nation endured another Pearl Harbor. Personally, I have my doubts. There might be a collective anger and unity for a while, like there was after 9/11. I lived through that one. But I have trouble imagining it holding through four traumatic years as hundreds of thousands of American boys died overseas. We can debate that. But what we can't debate is the fact that these World War II vets are disappearing quickly. Guys like Charlie Wiley and Lew Conter are unfortunately a vanishing breed. They're worth memorializing, whether on Memorial Day or any other day. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KPVS-FM in Hilo, Hawaii, KLUA-FM in Kona, Hawaii, along with WMCR-AM in North Syracuse, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.